I'm Nish Wyseth.
I'm Amy Sullivan, and this is Impolite Company, a show where we talk about the tricky subjects polite people are supposed to avoid, especially religion and politics.
No, you are not hallucinating, listeners. We are back with a special Campaign 2020 episode of Impolite Company. Things have been happening, and we have thoughts and opinions about them, so we're going to talk about it. Hi, Amy.
Nish.
I'm so ready to talk about this.
I have been able to tell. You even rejoined Twitter.
I did. I rejoined Twitter. I need periodic breaks from Twitter, from that dark void of a hellscape, but... I was back. I'm like, I need to talk to someone about these debates and what I'm hearing. So it's good. It was good to be back, but I'm happy that we are getting some time to chat about all things election in this primary. I think it's super important, especially as things are starting to, I guess, heat up right before Super Tuesday. We've got South Carolina this week. Just a lot happening.
Absolutely. Yes. Every time I tried to think about the Democratic race, really last summer and last fall, I would try to add up all of the candidates in the race and just get overwhelmed, especially when I would come across somebody like John Delaney and not even remember that he existed, much less that he was still in the race.
Right.
But I feel like it's winnowing down now. And even though I really wish somebody like Kamala Harris or Cory Booker or Leon Castro, I wish they were still in the race.
Yep.
We have got a smaller group of people still, I would argue, heavily oversampled among old white dudes who yell.
I'm so tired of being yelled at, Amy.
Yes.
As we yell into our microphones.
It's a controlled scream over here. But yeah, this is why I really just follow the debates via Twitter. I don't actually listen to the debates directly these days because I wouldn't say triggered is the right word, because certainly it's not like I had lots of shouty men in my life when I was growing up, but I have never been able to hear a man yelling without like immediately tensing up and feeling extremely uncomfortable. And all these people who complain about not enjoying the sound of a woman's voice, whether it's Hillary Clinton or Amy Klobuchar or Elizabeth Warren, like, I don't think they have heard from those of us who have extreme reactions to loud men as well. And I was just conducting a thought experiment last night on Twitter of what things would be like if we'd in fact had 4 decades of punditry about how men needed to be really careful about how they speak and not be off-putting to women voters who find it obnoxious to be yelled at all of the time.
Yeah. I mean, I even made a joke last night and said, is it okay if we call Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden shrill at this point?
They're so strident. I want to like them, but they're so strident. Why can't they smile more?
Right? They're kind of bitchy. That's what I want to say. Oh my gosh. But I mean, that's a good question. Like, could we imagine how the landscape in our political discourse would be different if those roles were reversed? I mean, obviously, we can all imagine and we can speculate, but at the same time, like, here we are. And it was really interesting watching that, particularly last night. For those of you who watched the debate, Amy, I know you didn't watch it. You just followed it on Twitter, but it was awful. It was terrible. You couldn't make out what people were saying. And at one point, you could see Elizabeth Warren, and I think it was when Biden and Buttigieg were going back and forth, she stood there and with her arms to each side looking at these men and looked at the moderators and said, this has to stop. Like, it was so powerful and honestly kind of wonderful to see the women on the stage looking so incredibly presidential, looking so composed, not emotional. Not that like we should be expected to do that, but they were far and away the most mature on that stage. And I know that there's a ton of expectations that come with that, right? Like women are expected to go above and beyond. But really, in this, in the landscape of the debate last night, it made all those men look like little children. And it was quite a dynamic to watch.
Well, you raise a few things that I've been thinking about women. One is that we have been really lucky, even though there still are very specific requirements that women have to stay in to be perceived as a serious candidate. We have been lucky to have Elizabeth Warren and Amy Klobuchar and Kamala Harris and Kirsten Gillibrand and OK Tulsi and Marianne Robinson, just all sorts of very different images of women and sounds of women. Like that on its own, instead of Hillary Clinton having to carry the burden of every expectation that's put on female politicians and female candidates, I just want more of that. And I think it's been really good for us as a country. The other thing is, you know, you ask the counterfactual of, you know, what would it be like if we had expectations for, you know, men needing to maybe behave themselves a little more to sound presidential and sound responsible. What has finally maybe convinced me with Elizabeth Warren, because I was doing the same thing everybody else does, which is being really concerned that the country just doesn't have it together and isn't going to vote for a woman, is knowing that we're never going to get there without getting there. By which I mean, after 4 years of watching a woman in the Oval Office and a woman behind that presidential seal, and every single time they play Hail to the Chief, a woman walks in and you hear her and it gets normalized, like somehow people have kind of normalized seeing Donald Trump as the president. Like that changes paradigms and expectations the way nothing else can. The thing is figuring out how you get a woman in there when people are still stuck with their old expectations and paradigms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And honestly, for all of Hillary's faults and flaws, and there were many, she did women such an incredible service by reaching the point that she did, right? Because now we at least have a blueprint for what it looks like to have a woman running for president. We have an idea of what that's going to look like. Now, granted, Hillary brought in a lot of baggage that is very specific to Hillary Clinton, but we are actually hearing less now about, you know, the woman's tone of voice, like, oh, she sounds shrill. She sounds like there's actually less of that, I have noticed, in our coverage and in the commentariat.
I would submit that's because we've got a couple dudes up at the top of the national
board. That's, yeah, that is probably true too.
Because how many times did you have somebody say to you, because I certainly heard this all the time in 2016, it's just Hillary. I mean, she is a uniquely bad candidate, but like, can you imagine Elizabeth Warren? She'd be amazing. Well, okay, buddy. Here she is.
Put your money with your mouth. Yeah, exactly. Exactly right. That's very true. I will submit to that point. But I will say that it is nice now to at least like look at a field of candidates and have so many women and have it not be this like shocking visual anymore, which it was wonderful at the same time when Hillary ran for president. Like I'll never forget sitting there watching her walk out in her white power suit at the Democratic convention and watching that with my daughter and her seeing me cry and asking me what's the matter and me getting the chance to explain to her what that meant. Now girls and women will look at women running for president as a normal thing. Now, granted, we have a long way to go. Like we have not, of course, reached where we need to reach. But it is super nice to look at this field of candidates, especially in the earlier days of it, and go like, man, what a change.
I cannot imagine that we'll be able to have a Democratic primary season without a woman candidate going forward.
Correct.
Or without people of color.
Yes.
I mean, yes. It is a huge bummer that we are now not even to Super Tuesday. And
they're all out. Yeah, that That is true. That is true. And that has been super depressing to watch as the primary has rolled on, is to see candidates like Cory Booker, who I had really high hopes for, and Kamala Harris and Joaquin Castro. I didn't think that Joaquin Castro would actually get that far. I don't think he had quite the name recognition that he needed in such a crowded field. But Kamala Harris specifically, just with her precision of prosecution and watching those viral clips of her in the Senate. And I thought for sure she was just going to be a slam dunk for a lot of people. Cory Booker had a really engaging message of, you know, unity and hopefulness that felt very Obama, and felt very healing after the last 4 years specifically of a Trump presidency. And yeah, I miss those candidates a lot. I think that the Democratic Party particularly is going to have a lot of reckoning to do. They're going to have a lot of reckoning to do at the end of this primary to talk about what happened. How does the most diverse field in the party's history whittle down to an all-white field, particularly with two old white 70-plus-year-old men at the top as front runners? What happened and where did we go wrong? I mean, obviously, everybody can make their speculations and a lot of them would probably be right. But I think that that's going to be a big reckoning for the party. How does the most diverse party in the most diverse time in American history end up this way? That's going to be a question they're going to have to answer.
Yeah, I keep asking how, right after the 2018 midterms, which were powered by the rage of women and the activism of women,
particularly women of color.
How do you end up with a party that keeps trying to rally around one of three different old white dudes?
I know.
Any one of whom could just drop dead tomorrow of a heart attack.
One of them did have a heart attack, like not that long ago.
And he's older than my dad, and I wouldn't let my dad run around the country.
Oh, what a time.
You were asking how did we get to this point? And I think one of the reasons we got to this point is that my profession of journalists have learned very little from 2016 and continue to make some of these same errors.
No.
In part because there was not enough self-reflection. Nobody likes to admit that they did anything wrong, but the stakes are really freaking high now. And there is more than just your ego at risk here. And it drives me insane.
Right
after Iowa, for no good reason that I can see, it was just a discussion of Bernie and Pete. Nobody else. And I ended up writing a piece last week about the anger, the women who are just livid, not necessarily because they think, you know, Elizabeth Warren just deserves to be the nominee over anybody else, or Amy Klobuchar or Kamala Harris did, but just the almost casual way in which the women candidates were just being brushed aside.
Erased.
Erasure. Yes.
Yeah.
And part of that, I was yelling about it to work the refs. You know, there's a little more attention to it, but even after the Las Vegas debate, which I did watch part of and was awesome, all the headlines were in the passive voice, but it was like Bloomberg gets pummeled or comes in for harsh questioning. None of it was the active voice, and we're always taught to use active voice, that Elizabeth Warren did the pummeling. Elizabeth Warren did the mauling. It was as if, you know, he just stood there and somebody dumped slime on him, like, and nobody knows where it came from. That just drives me insane. And then one more thing I'll bring up, which may get us into our familiar, comfortable round of religion and politics, is even now I have been seeing commentary from political reporters who follow this stuff saying it's so weird that Democrats just they haven't mentioned religion at all this
time. Oh my God. Joe
said at the end of some speech, like, God bless you. And somebody pointed that out. I was like, the rare mention of God by a Democrat. And yeah, that once makes me want to tear my hair out. And I think underscores to me how much of this is just preconception about Democrats that must serve as a filter on journalists' ears, that they cannot hear religion for what it is or see religion for what it is unless it comes in the form of a Republican. And flip side of that is they just can't recognize it from Democrats because they expect Democrats won't be using the language of faith. We should get into mm-hmm. some examples of that. And I know you've been paying particular attention to the mayor from South Bend.
Hmm. I would like to go ahead and insert in our very regular public service announcement to any news organization or publication to hire religion reporters. It is super helpful. And adds a lot of context and depth and nuance to your reporting.
We can always use more religion reporters. There are a lot of good religion reporters, but somebody spouts off on Twitter like that, and I guarantee that there's 100 other journalists who nod their heads and are like, quite true. That's true. We just don't hear about God from Democrats.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, like Twitter collectively like losing its mind that, did Elizabeth Warren just quote the Bible on stage and use the King James Version? I'm like, she is a born and bred UMC kid from Oklahoma. Of course she used the King James Version. And of course she quoted from the Bible. She taught Sunday school. Like, but if you knew, like, if you had any context or depth to the religion narrative of these candidates, all of them, then we would be like, this would not be as shocking. You know what I mean? It's just, ugh. That's how I feel about it. But yes, the mayor of South Bend. The reason why I have been paying particular attention to him is that he has, in a way that I think the religious left has wanted for a really long time, has wanted someone to capitalize on the same language of faith that has been co-opted by the religious right for decades, to finally use it in a way that is effective to talk about progressive policies. And I think that's why he has stood out. I think that's why, especially to religion reporters, like from an early stage in these debates, in the race, in the primary, Pete has stood out in that regard because he was the first one that was kind of like unabashedly willing to use religious language. He's certainly been one of the more overt candidates that I have seen in recent years, including a one President Barack Obama, in talking about the way that his faith shapes his political and policy views. That, in a way, for me, as someone who would identify as part of the religious left, has been refreshing. It has been really great to finally see someone be unabashed in that regard and actually talk about it in a way that the right has done for so long and in a way that actually feels more inclusive. And the way that he has framed his faith and the way that he has framed it in regards to his policy and saying, like, listen, if I'm elected president, my faith will certainly inform my policies because that's who I am, but I'm the president for everyone, people of faith and people of no faith, and has been very clear about that. And that's like, oh, it's so nice to see someone just be explicit. I don't know. How do you feel?
Oh, I think he's been incredibly adept at it. And, you know, the cool thing these days is to make fun of Mayor Pete for being overly earnest. But you know what? Midwesterners are earnest. Like, get over it. That's who we are.
Yep.
I find it just familiar and a bit endearing. But we can also be very pointed when we want to. And that is another way that I think he has stuck out. Like I've said this before, and I apologize to listeners if I'm repeating myself. Every so often, Democrats have had somebody like a Joe Biden who, I think it was in 2008, he said something like, if anybody questions my Catholicism again, I'm going to shove my rosary down their throat, which, you know, is going on the offensive, I suppose, but still in a very defensive way. Yes. And maybe a little much, Uncle Joe, like that. Mm-hmm. Just, you got some rage issues there.
Mm-hmm.
But Pete has, from the beginning, taken it to people like Mike Pence in a way that I think progressives love and have been dearly hungering for. And what right. I think he was very smart to notice, because I was concerned going into this presidential cycle that Democrats were going to look at the numbers that show their largest growing bloc among religiously unaffiliated, and they were going to draw the conclusion that religion is a loser for them, and they needed to make their language as secular as possible. And I think perhaps because he's from this millennial generation and understands that being disaffected mm-hmm. and disillusioned with religious institutions is not the same thing as being disaffected and disillusioned with God.
Right.
And so he has been able to use his faith. I think it was in one of the summer debates, he said he was taking on Republicans who are blocking a bill to raise the minimum wage. And he said, so-called conservative Christian senators, so-called conservatives, like, how often do you hear a Democrat talk about Republicans as so-called conservative Christians? Mm-hmm. Right now in the Senate are blocking a bill to raise the minimum wage when scripture says, whoever oppresses the poor taunts their maker. That is a deep cut. That is not Matthew 25, and I'm not knocking Elizabeth Warren, but Matthew 25 is Democrats' very favorite scripture. And I think for a lot of people who have not been to church in decades who could still tell you some version of Matthew 25. It's kind of like the golden rule at this point. But whoever oppresses the poor taunts their yep. maker, that is a deep cut. And it was used really, really well. He talks about the moral hypocrisy yep. of the right. He snapped back at Mike Pence when Mike Pence was making noises about how maybe America didn't need mm-hmm. a gay candidate, and said, if you've got a problem with who I am, your problem is not with me. Your quarrel, sir, is with my creator.
Is with my maker. Yeah, yeah, that's right.
And I think people react really well to that, because it's not just mm-hmm. being comfortable talking about his own faith. It's being so comfortable in his own faith that he can push back at your characterization of it and say, you need to question your own yeah. faith. Not that I want to endorse politics devolving into some sort of mm-hmm. like faith off,
right.
but he could win a faith off.
Yeah, he definitely could. I mean, what are those competitions that kids would have? The
sword drills.
Sword drills. That dude. I mean, I think Elizabeth Warren would crush a sword drill.
Elizabeth Warren.
But I mean, just Pete, out of sheer overachiever status, I bet he would crush pretty hard too, let's be honest. Now, obviously, there are a lot of critiques here about Pete with the African-American community in particular and his lack of support. And it is absolutely worth talking about, and it is absolutely worth being concerned about. And it's one of the things I am most concerned about. However, it has been really interesting to watch his language about the poor in particular, talking more about the poor than about the middle class, as he has spent more time listening to Black religious leaders. And that is reflective, I think, of the language of Reverend Dr. Barber and the Poor People's Campaign, the work of a lot of Black religious activists on the ground. And I don't think it's to be overlooked.
Yeah, I think he walks a bit of a fine line there, because it's very tricky. You'll hear a lot of pushback at the idea that politicians only talk about crime and poverty when they talk about race. But as you point out, Reverend Barber and other Black church leaders have been at the forefront of trying to get people. I mean, yep. it goes back to Martin Luther King's Poor People's Campaign, the original one.
Yep, the original one, yeah.
To get attention, because there's been no question that wealth and race are intertwined, and wealth and racism mm-hmm. are intertwined in this country. So it is tricky, and I think Pete does not come into these discussions with the benefit of the doubt. But as you say, he has reflected the ability to grow, as I think Elizabeth Warren has. She has had sit-downs with groups that have been really pushing her and has come up with her plans, because she's got a plan for everything.
And that's what we love about Elizabeth Warren, right? Like, I mean, there's a lot of things I love about her, but man, like the thing I love about her too is not that she has a plan for everything, but like she has a plan for the plan. Like, how are we going to get the plan enacted? You know what I mean? Like, she's got a strategy for Mitch McConnell as much as she has a strategy for the actual policy. And I'm like, I love a woman who can play chess, you know, like it's just.
Which is why I think, like, no question, she would be the best president of anybody up there. It's just whether talking about plans moves voters. And I'm not sure it does. I think it gets her past the threshold of, like, do we consider you serious? And could we see you as president? But after that, there might be diminishing returns.
Yeah. Yep. I agree. Although I will say, man, that woman is not even president and she got Mike Bloomberg to release some women from their NDAs. Like, she can get some shit done. Yeah. Like, it was just one example of, like, man, she can put some feet to the fire and make it happen, which was actually really awesome to see on a whole lot of levels. But anyway, back to religion.
So let's talk for a minute, because this is the first class of presidential candidates on the Democratic side where we have had multiple candidates not just speaking in religious language, but hiring religious outreach staffers during the primary process. It's not that that hasn't existed before. In 2008, Hillary Clinton had Bernd Strider and Barack Obama had Josh Dubois. And I think that's a big reason why the two of them, plus John Edwards, participated in a debate sponsored by Call to Renewal, Jim Wallace's organization, during the primaries.
Oh, that's right.
6 months before the primary started. So it's not that we haven't seen this at all, but again, 2008 was a different time than 2020. I thought perhaps because of the growing numbers of religiously unaffiliated, combined with the really bad reputation that religion has earned from the behavior of the Christian right, would just keep the Democrats an arm's length away from religion. And that was not the case, but I want to talk about whether it accomplished anything. So Pete Buttigieg and Cory Booker are the two who I know hired religious outreach staffers. Both of those picks were pretty solidly from progressive religious communities. Not that you would expect anything else, but from the pool of people that you would kind of expect to be out there already involved in Democratic politics. So not trying to persuade anybody. And I'm losing it off the top of my head right now, but there were a handful of other candidates who had somebody who was at least part-time focused on faith outreach, which is new.
And Elizabeth Warren has actually a council of interfaith advisors.
And you just cannot win on the Democratic side. We should point out that all of this, when it comes to faith outreach, is so much easier for Republicans because they have such a homogenous base. In fact, Trump has just done away even with having a diverse Christian council. He's just evangelicals at this point. No mainliners.
Just Paula White.
Got a bunch of prosperity gospel preachers, and that is it.
And the people from Bethel. That's what's happening. We got the Bethel people. That's fun.
Yeah. So I saw complaints that Warren didn't have a conservative and an Orthodox and a Reform rabbi in her council, and she didn't have somebody from here and there. And like, I do hope that every group can have its voice heard, but I do not think that it is productive to hit Democratic candidates when the dude in the White House is just listening to a tiny sliver of America.
It's getting very frustrating to watch, even in terms of religious and faith outreach, having to watch candidates tread so lightly and watch them tread so carefully. because of fear of outrage, because of fear of not hitting every mark, mm-hmm. I think we're starting to get into a little bit of dangerous territory there. That in particular could make it harder to build a big tent coalition of people who would normally be fine being a Democrat or be fine voting for a Democratic candidate, particularly in this election against a candidate like Donald Trump. But because they don't hit every ideological box, they are told that they don't fit. Pete says this sometimes, and I think that it comes across the wrong way, but like, are we in our own small ways instituting ideological purity tests? Not just in like big issues like Medicare for all and, you know, all that kind of stuff, but even in our small ways of picking a faith advisor or multiple thereof.
No, it's a good question to ask because it is one of, I would say, the chief challenges for activists these days. You want people who are constantly pushing the outer border because we're not where we should be, and we're not going to get where we should be unless you have some people saying, this isn't good enough. At the same time, I do think, and we've talked a lot about this, that there are some softened voters who are extremely uncomfortable with what they've seen over the last 3 years. And instead of showing them the back of your hand and saying, well, then you shouldn't have voted for him, it would be nice, wouldn't it, to at least make them feel like they don't have a duty to vote against the Democratic nominee and maybe even offer a hand into the progressive coalition. How do you do both? Well, by not demanding that one person or one group cover both messages at the same time, by understanding you can have multiple people speaking to multiple audiences and have faith that at the end of the day, you know what your priorities are. This is what really, 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 really worries me about the abortion issue.
That's where I was headed.
Unfortunately, we don't have another hour to go into this.
Yeah, no, and we have a lot of really great episodes where we talk about abortion that we can link to in the show notes.
This is something where it surprises people when I say there is no cattle call on the right where National Right to Life Committee holds a town hall and they demand that all the Republican candidates come and speak. Mm-hmm. They let those candidates off the hook because they know it's better for their movement overall if they can let those candidates be vague. Every activist on the left thinks that everybody knows where Republicans stand when it comes to abortion, mm-hmm. but it turns out not everybody does. And it's because they can get away with using code words and by talking about sanctity of life, which sounds like a very good thing that everybody is into, they don't make everybody stand up and pledge to protect with their dying breath Roe v. Wade, which is a right that I think needs to be protected. But I am comfortable assuming that any Democratic president who's elected is going to protect that right and is furthermore not going to appoint judges who will specifically overturn Roe and not push Congress to put forward legislation that's going to ban abortion. I could feel okay about that without needing the candidate to stand up and smack me in the face with it. But especially because there are very good reasons to be scared right now if you're in the choice activist community, I just worry that they're going to double down and push away, especially some mainline women, some Catholic women. So that's my concern. And that's where, you know, even somebody like Cory Booker, who we both like and who has, in general, I think, a really good ear for faith and also for religious communities, they're not unfamiliar to him. He spends a lot of time around them. He stands up and says something like abortion is healthcare. And I know what he means, but I also know that's the spot that's going to run nonstop in the fall if he's the nominee. I know it may run nonstop regardless, even though he's not going to be the nominee. And I don't think that's the way you want to frame the conversation.
No, I don't either. And I think that there's a lot, I mean, there's always nuance lacking, right? Like always, always, always. It's our perpetual problem. But when you have questions coming from an audience to a Democratic nominee that says, like, I'm pro-life, is there space for me in the party? And they essentially say no. That's a problem because we do a disservice by also articulating that there are many different ways in which one can be pro-life, right? Like, I consider myself a pro-life Democrat, but I consider myself a pro-life Democrat because I believe Roe v. Wade is the law of the land. I don't want to see it overturned, but I do want to see abortions reduced, right? That is being pro-life. Like, I would like to see that number come down. I don't want it to be outlawed, and I don't want doctors or mothers being criminalized for having an abortion. Like, I don't think that's the best way to be pro-life. And so we lack the nuance to address a very, very, very complex issue, and we only make it even more tenuous, more precarious, and more difficult for people to join a coalition that, frankly, we have to win. Like, we have to build that coalition, number one, of a wide breadth of voters, but we also have to have the momentum going into a general, right? Like, we have to have turnout. People have to be enthusiastic about the person that they're voting for in order to go to the polls. And if the person at the top of the ticket is someone who tells them they're not welcome in the party, even though their policies align, do you think they're going to have a lot of enthusiasm? No. And so we have to find a better way to talk about it. We have to find a better way to be inclusive and say, like, this is where we stand as a party. Roe v. Wade should be protected. It is the law of the land. Women do have a right to choose, you know, all of the right things, right? To articulate that, but then also say, we also understand that there are a lot of different ways to be pro-life. And to acknowledge that on the other side, I think would go a long way in holding out the hand to all of those disaffected Trump voters who, yeah, should not have voted for the guy in the first place. But here we are now. Absolutely, we would like your vote to get that guy out of office. We should not be turning those people away simply because we're not willing to have a hard conversation. And I think that it's going to be really important for whoever the nominee is to be able to be honest about that and to say, this is who we are and what we believe. This is a part of our platform, but we also understand that there's a lot of gray area and we want to have that conversation with you. Come over, let us have that chat.
We're going to wrap up this show with some recommendations for listeners. Do you have anything for us?
Yes, I do. I have two things. The first one is a wonderful podcast hosted by a friend of the pod, Propaganda, Christian hip hop artist, amazing spoken word poet. He has a great podcast that he has with his wife, Alma, who actually is Dr. Alma. Their podcast is the Red Couch Podcast over with the Liturgists. But Prop just started one that's kind of like an offshoot of that podcast, and it's called Hood Politics. And what he does is he really takes big political issues, everything from like global tariffs to what happened with the killing of the Iranian general, and brings it down into a context that the everyday person can understand. He does such a good job. And selfish plug here, he actually just had me on last week and we called it Wood Politics to try to help people understand that the issues that are affecting people in rural communities are actually not that different from the issues affecting urban communities, and to help people understand that divide. Me living in, you know, small 3,000 person rural town in Idaho and him living in downtown LA. And we talked about that and talked about some of those issues, and it was super awesome. He has just an infinite intellectual curiosity, asks amazing questions. So it's worth giving it a listen. So that's my first one. And then just something fun. There's a great new show on Apple Plus or Apple TV Plus, if you have it. It's called Mythic Quest. And I cannot believe I'm recommending a show about video games, but it is so funny. If you are a fan of the show Almost Sunny in Philadelphia, you will love Mythic Quest. It's made by the same people, except it's less crass and raunchy. definitely quick wit, super fast humor, a little dark. Amazing. Eric and I just finished the first season and we laughed and laughed and laughed and laughed the whole way through it. It's got a really great cast. Definitely worth watching. Amy, what about you?
Well, I want to recommend another podcast by another friend of the pod, Danielle Mayfield, hosts with her husband. It's called The Prophetic Imagination Station. And some of their seasons I have not been able to totally relate to because we're from kind of different generations of evangelical childhoodness. But they are doing a season where they are discussing and interviewing people about the Frank Peretti novel, This Present Darkness, which I read cover to cover many times as a high school Baptist. And it's really, it was at the time and still is kind of a quick, fun read. But I was just listening last night to their first episode where they talk about one of the themes that just totally went over my head when I was a teenager, which is kind of the supposed epidemic of girls being influenced by demons to lodge sexual assault allegations against men of faith that really is disturbing in terms of how it informs a lot of the thinking that went into Church 2 examples and the kind of circling of the wagons to protect religious leaders instead of protecting women. So I think just to say that there are going to be some really interesting conversations out of this, more than just nostalgia for me. Still have not seen Goonies, Nish, so you got to have me out to Idaho at some point so we can have a movie night. And I want to wrap this up with a quick prayer request because people, I lost my damn mind and I volunteered to chaperone a kindergarten field trip to the aquarium on Friday morning.
What?
Friday, dude, all
what
day.
What are you thinking?
Oh, it gets worse. It gets worse, Nish. I also volunteered to chaperone our church youth lock-in, which I did not realize was the same day.
No.
I may not make it.
I would lay hands on you. I would lay hands and anoint you with oil. That is what I would do. My charismatic side would come out. Okay, that is all for this special episode. Thank you so much for joining us. We've missed you. If you've enjoyed our conversation, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. It's the very best way to let other people know about us. And until next time, have fun storming the castle, kids.